morning. And just in case you wondered why there's a different voice, this is Erin. Elizabeth is out sick this morning, so hope everybody set their clocks back. We're into daylight savings time, and we've got our guest with us this morning. Oh, sorry, I didn't set our clocks back forward. Sorry, setting them back's the part I like. A little Freudian slip there. Good thing Nate's here. We've got Fred Grant with us this morning, and he is traveling the North State for the next couple of days. He has been in Siskiyou County the last 2 days, helping those guys up there with the process of coordination, working on how to help us keep our public lands ours. I was talking to the sheriff up there yesterday, last night actually, at an event, and those guys are being overrun. I think all our forests are being overrun. We've got, you know, drug cartels growing major amounts of marijuana in the forest, but the roads are being closed to people who want to hike, fish, and hunt. And having I know, Nate's laughing. Like, it makes no sense. No sense whatsoever. So, anyway, we are looking to recover some of those kinds of things, and there are some meetings coming up. I want you to really pay close attention to public meeting notices. Those notices that come out about, oh, the phone company having a meeting in your local area about changes in service. You've got PG&E having smart meter meetings. You have Forest Services. I am not able to get my computer up right at the moment, but when I do, I'll look up the date for you. It is just crazy. They're having these public meetings, and people don't go. Most of us haven't gone for years because we didn't really know what it was for. And we figured it was just some sort of a rule they had to, you know, they had to have these meetings. Well, they do, because they need to include us in the process. And the way we are included in the process is to attend those meetings, ask questions, and listen for changes that are upcoming. That way everything doesn't wind up being a surprise. So I think we have Fred Grant with us. Hey, Fred.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
Hey, we're great. So did you miss the hour that you had to get back last night?
I will be tired until October.
I am the exact same way.
Yeah, every year. I just think, why do they do this to me?
I know, it ruins me. I had a friend growing up in Connecticut, and her dad, he refused to do the hour switch. He would only switch 15 minutes a day until he finally got to the hour.
You know, I'm so bad about that when I go to New York, I leave my time on mountain time.
Oh, there you go.
So that I, in my mind, I haven't changed the time.
Yeah,
the
just,
time period.
Well, he just...
Plus, it's very practical, because if I'm going to call back home, I know what time it is. If I need to call the governor's office, I know when it's closed and when it isn't.
It's kind of funny. Yeah, he was he'd be 45 minutes late the first day, and then he's half hour late the second day, and he's 15 minutes late the third day.
Yeah.
He was just a difficult sort.
The time business, when I was counsel to Governor Andrews, the Hispanics, the migrant council, were to come in for a meeting, and they weren't there on time, and I waited about 30 minutes, and I went back to my other office, and I told his secretary, the governor's secretary, well, she called me pretty soon and said, they're there. And I said, well, they're late. She said, well, they laughed and said that they're on Hispanic time. And I said, well, tell them Fred Grant time, they're late. And so she called me back in about 2 minutes, and she said, the governor says Fred Grant will be on Hispanic time today. I said, oh, okay, I'll be back over.
I know. We need to go Arizona. You know, those guys just drew a line and said, "Okay, forget it."
That's right.
Well, so can you coordinate that for us? I mean, you have a program in your magic bag of tricks for that.
It would be good if I could.
Wouldn't that be nice? Hey, I was talking to the sheriff last night up there. We had an event I had to attend, and he was saying that he spoke to you for quite a while, and he was pretty. Yeah. He had a spring in his step.
He's a good man. I am very impressed with that sheriff, and I told him that if when I come back, I'll bring Gary Eamon up, who was our sheriff in Waiheke County, who put in the policies that the BLM accepted, and they in writing accepted the fact that the sheriff's the primary law officer.
Yeah, he was feeling pretty good about that. He was very excited about the help that he got, and that, you know, he said, well, you know, I think I have kind of more authority than a lot of people in the county. And I was like, yes.
Oh, yes, he does. Yeah, he does. Under Homeland Security, the order is to coordinate with local government, but also with local elected officials. So even if his county doesn't do it, he's got the authority under Homeland Security to coordinate with them, get equipment, get money. He's got a lot of authority that he's the good point is that he's ready to use it. I mean, he has the mindset to use it.
Yeah, he understands what's going on.
Yeah, all he needs is the specific information as to where that authority is backed up in the law, and that's what we'll provide him.
Hey, Fred, you've been our guest on this program before, but
yes.
Do me a favor and give folks kind of a thumbnail sketch of where you've been, because you have quite the history.
Oh, yeah, it's been a checkered history.
And we can now add daylight savings time hater to it.
How long do we have before we're on the air?
Oh, we've got a couple of minutes here, three minutes.
Let me tell you a quick story about my checkered past. I had a bad accident in April this past year and should have been killed. I mean, there's no reason why I was left alive. I told the executive vice president of the University of Idaho, I said, Stephen, I don't know whether God still has a purpose for me or whether he's just not ready to judge me. And he said, oh, it's the latter. He doesn't have an evaluation form long enough to take into account your first 50 years and try to write them off. So I think maybe
that's,
he's
that's
right.
Kind of a nice card to play.
Yeah, that's right.
That's good, because we have a lot of problems. You're going to help us forever then.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, somebody on the... I was on a radio show in Boise this morning, one of my friends, Doug McConaughey, down there, and they were talking about, fortunately, we don't have to have a union to get into heaven. We don't need anybody there to speak for us. And I said, well, you guys speak for yourselves. I'm going to need somebody. Oh, my.
Well,
it's good to be here. It's beautiful country.
Yeah, have you been up there before?
I was in Yreka, but I never got a tour of the country like I did the day before yesterday. Craig and Richard and Susan took me on the tour of the valley, and I mean, it's just beautiful country. You know, I've always had feelings for you folks up here, but now it's real. Because I see the land, and I see what you've done with it, and that just makes a big difference.
Yeah, now you know what you're saving.
Yep, that's right. That's exactly right.
So tell people a little bit about your background before the accident.
You mean now or on the air?
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, give them a little, because, right. We're on the air now, actually.
I'm sorry. I didn't realize that. I went to the College of Idaho in Idaho and majored in constitutional history and law. Did a boring honors paper on the genesis of the Articles of Confederation and found out it was fascinating to me, which showed I had no life even at that point. And then went to the University of Chicago Law School, which was a very conservative constitutional law school, very liberal social professors, but not with the Constitution. So I learned it the right way, I think. And then went to, I was with Lord Bissell and Brooke in Chicago for about a year and a half. They represented Lloyd's of London for various reasons, including my wife's health. We went to Baltimore to be near the Johns Hopkins, and I was clerk to the Chief Judge of the Maryland Court of Appeals, which is the Supreme Court of Maryland. Then I became an Assistant United States Attorney, the youngest one ever appointed in Maryland, and I think before my career there was over, the U.S. attorney questioned whether or not he had made a wise judgment, because I was kind of the wild card among his staff. I took chances that nobody else would in court. Then I left and went to the state's attorney's office in Baltimore, where I was the chief felony lawyer and finally chief of the organized crime division. And when I left there, after the state's attorney When it went on the bench, the new state's attorney didn't think organized crime was all that important, so I left and went out and started defending them, the ones that I'd been trying to put away all those years. When my oldest son was ready to go to school, Lodice, my late wife, wanted to come home to Idaho. We did. I was counsel to Governor Cecil Andrus until he became Secretary of Interior, and then I stayed on as counsel to John Evans as governor. Then I worked for the 3rd Judicial District Court in setting up a research center and law clerks for them, and I stayed there, and then as deputy clerk to the Canyon County Commissioners for several years and helped them in their efforts to stay away from federal regulations, as I had with the governors. And then finally, 20 years ago, and then I did death penalty work for the public defender. Had about 9 cases that I argued on death penalty issues, not the guilt or innocence, but just on the penalty. And then 20 years ago, I started helping Owyhee County in southwestern Idaho. Their ranchers were under the gun. There was a record of decision that was about to be issued that would reduce their grazing 40%. None of them could have survived that. And I discovered the coordination language in the federal statutes, and I told the ranchers that I could get them about 2 years through the administrative process, and 20 years later, they're still in business. None of them have lost their allotments. In fact, some of them have regained some of the grazing they lost. I guess about 2 years after that, I helped Modoc County in Northern California, not too far from you folks, over in Alturas. I helped Sean Curtis and Carolyn Carey get coordination established with their Board of Supervisors. And for 15 years, Modoc and Owyhee were the only 2 counties in the country using this process. And other counties around would look at us and with kind of envy and say, we don't understand why you're getting such benefits from the Forest Service, the BLM. Nobody else used the process.
Hey, friend, we've got to take a little break here. Otherwise, we're going to be... We're going to do them every 15 minutes, so we'll get back on schedule at 8:30, but got to take a break, thank our advertisers. You're listening to KCNR 1460 AM. We'll be right back with Fred Grant. You're here at the home of Free Fire Media. Welcome back to We the People. You are listening to KCNR 1460 AM. Hey, I wanted to let people know that you can find us online at ReadingTeaParty.com. And if you go to ReadingTeaParty.com, you will see the radio button at the top. When you click on that, a fabulous page will open up. It'll not only have this program, but it'll have all the programs we've done in the past, along with all the information about the people who've been on the show. You can listen to those archived programs. You can order CDs of those programs. And I'll just give you a little heads up now. Next week, we're getting into the political Islam issue. And we have a guy that was traveling here from England. We pre-recorded the show a week or so ago, so you don't want to miss next week. It's taking us, I guess, not necessarily in a different direction, because it's definitely a constitutional issue, definitely a limited government issue. I'm not sure it's a fiscal responsibility issue, but I figure 2 out of 3 is not bad. So you guys are going to really like next week. This week, we've got Fred Kelly Grant on the phone with us from beautiful Siskiyou County, and we also have Craig Chenoweth on there from the Protect Our Water Group. Hi, men.
Good morning.
All right. So, hey, Fred, I liked it at the beginning when you didn't think we were on the air and you were all chatty. That was fun.
Pardon?
I liked it at the beginning when you didn't think we were on the air and you were all chatty.
Oh, yeah. I'm just sitting here getting awake and looking at the mountains out there, and I didn't realize we were.
No, that's great. You're always very, you know, spit spot. People always hear formal Fred, so it was fun for them to hear just you. So,
one of the things I told you informally, I don't know whether that got on the air, but... From this morning on, I'll be tired until October or whenever it is that the time changes back.
I I'm with you too. We'll have a whole bunch of people tune in about a half an hour, and they'll be like, "What do you mean it's the second half?"
That's right.
Surprise. This is about every other every couple of 2-3 years we'd miss church, you know, and my dad would pull into the parking lot while everybody was pulling out or pulling in, and he was just fit to be tied. So it always kind of gives me a little chuckle.
That's right.
Well, how do you guys, how do you think everything went the last couple of days up there? You guys have held two pretty major meetings. Give us an update on what's happening up there.
I'll let Craig do it first because he's the one that that observes what's going on, and then I'll tell you how I viewed it as the speaker and presenter.
Well, I thought we had a wonderful time up here. I learned an incredible amount from Fred, and mostly what I was learning was about the process, because the coordination process is such a valuable tool, and you can read the definitions of how you're supposed to go through the theory of it and kind of grasp how you can use it. But when you have a creative man like Fred who understands the intricacies of the projects that are involved here and how to approach them, it makes it much easier to put the coordination process into place right here in Siskiyou County for our needs and our uses. As he taught us, it doesn't transcend in one blank page for everybody. It has to be designed specifically for us. So it's been a phenomenal weekend.
And so, Craig, the application that you guys are, I mean, I know there are many needs, but what's the application you're working on for the folks that are just catching up with some of these issues?
Well, basically, there's a lot of things we need to be coordinated on. We had a meeting yesterday morning with some folks from Happy Camp on the monument issue. The president has proposed a monument in our backyard, and we are just now working with the people from Happy Camp. Actually, they're doing a phenomenal job in terms of trying to get a grasp on the coordination process to work with the Forest Service to be their managers. And that's what exactly that they're learning, is that the Forest Service and all these state and federal agencies work for us. It's really important to grasp that concept early in the process so that as we go down the road to figure out how we're going to resolve these problems, that we understand whose role it is to be doing what. And the folks in Happy Camp have just moved so quickly and so brilliantly to be able to put the ideas forth. And yesterday we learned a whole new strategy from Fred on being able to work with other outside businesses, help us support what we want to do. In the terms of a monument, that monument, of course, they chose it where the best timber, the best water, the best natural minerals are. They decided that that's what they are going to take from us. Well, they're not going to take anything from us. We're going to allow them to help us develop it, but on our terms. And that's what we've been learning. We've had a much better, clear price project example that Fred laid out for us yesterday in terms of working well with the state and federal agencies and being able to come to a really good, swift resolve over how we're going to deal with the issues. So it's been an incredible learning curve for me.
Nice. I didn't know the coordination would work for the monument. That's fantastic.
Well, I'll let Fred explain that to you.
All right. Hey, guys, if I could get you at your end, if you guys could be in different rooms, it may take some of the echo out.
Sure.
Okay.
Sorry. It's not as fun when you're in different rooms, but...
Not a problem.
But we're getting a little bit of an echo here on our end.
Is that better?
Yeah, that's a lot better.
Okay.
You have to look out different windows at the sun coming up.
We're doing that.
Thank you.
I'm looking at the beautiful mountains in the fog. Those mountains are beautiful whether you can see them or not. I mean, just the image of them through the fog is something else.
All right. So Fred, now that you're not echoing, tell us about how does coordination help with the monument? Because I thought it was mostly on the use of land, but I didn't know it could be on stopping the use of land.
There's two things to say. First of all, coordination does not help in preventing the monument. That's a political thing. Coordination doesn't work with the president. The president has absolute discretion in naming a monument. But there is a process that goes hand in hand with coordination, and that's the political process that people like Chuck Cushman from Battleground, I think it is, Washington, are proficient at. And, you know, he's got 500,000 email addresses, 750,000 fax addresses, 7 or 8 monuments he has managed to stop politically by organizing the approach to local federal representatives and senators and putting enough pressure on them politically that they then say to the White House, hey, wait a minute, you know, go somewhere else with the monument because we need this state. I need this job. And so he has stopped it that way. When they politically try to stop it, if it doesn't work, at least you have promoted the support then that the politicians understand. And then in the proclamation of the monument itself, there is identified a lead agency, normally the Department of Interior. And that agency is responsible for developing an implementation plan. A plan to implement the monument, and immediately, as soon as the proclamation is signed, local government has the right for the Secretary of Interior and his designees to come to the table and help them develop the implementation plan. And in the implementation plan, that's where the consistency requirement comes in. And when they're developing that plan as to how the monument will be implemented, they've got to be concerned with reaching consistency with local policy, which is don't ruin our economy, don't take grazing out, don't take our water rights, don't put restrictions on recreational use. Let us continue the multiple use that was in place that didn't destroy the land to the point where you want a monument there. In other words, the whole monument process ignores the fact that if users of the land had not taken good care of it, it wouldn't be worth a monument. So that's where the coordination then works. And hand in hand, you've got then a political battle up front, followed by the coordination approach as soon as it's proclaimed. And you've got a double-edged sword to go, or not a double-edged sword, you've got a two swords.
Sure.
To go after the monument.
That's going to be useful as heck, and I think that's kind of the brightest spot I've heard in the monument, actually, in the whole process.
I represent 5 counties in Utah and 1 in Arizona, and we're going after the Grand Escalante Monument. It's the one that Clinton proclaimed way back when, and nobody coordinated from the local government standpoint, and so the plan eliminated grazing, eliminated hunting, eliminated recreation, but it's time for revision of that plan. And so I've been hired by those counties to go in and now use coordination to get some of those uses back into the monument.
That's awesome. We're going to take a quick break and come back. I want to hear more about the Escalante Monument because we have heard about that in the past and know very little about what happens to roll those things back. So when we come back with Fred Grant and Craig Chenoweth up there in Siskiyou County, we're going to learn more. To KCNR 1460 AM, Shasta Redding, the home of Free Fire Media. Welcome back to We the People. You are listening to us on KCNR 1460. You can pick us up online at the Redding Tea Party website. Go to www.readingteaparty.com, click on radio. And normally we would have you call in, but both our lines are taken up, so don't call in, just listen. You can also click on all the archives. I would direct you to the archive on January the 2nd. That was all about monuments. So for the people that don't really understand the comprehensive issue of monument and would like a lot more information, that January 2nd program, it's actually titled, I think Robert has it titled, yep, All About Monuments. So readingteaparty.com, click on radio, and there you go. I would like to thank Miller Auto Transport for sponsoring this part of the show. Bill Miller hauls everything, and we always say hauls things with wheels, but he also hauls boats and planes and all sorts of other stuff. So if it can be hauled, Miller Auto Transport hauls it. You can find information for him also on that media page. So, okay, we're back with Craig Chenoweth from the Protect Our Water Group and Mr. Fred Kelly Grant, who is traveling from Idaho to help people in the North State fight bureaucrats. Is that about the long and the short of it, Fred?
That's it.
All right.
That's it. They're a unique species.
They're a unique beast. So take us back to the Escalante staircase and tell us about that. That was Clinton's big thing. Now, how big is that monument?
Huge. And I can't tell you the exact number of millions of acres, but it is huge. And it took in the entire coal industry of southern Utah and took out all of that coal development down there. Ruined the economy of at least four counties in Utah. The promise was that there would be no impact on grazing, and that people would be able to continue to use it for their motorized vehicles on designated trails. Going to be no impact on hunting or anything else. And of course, we knew beforehand that that wasn't true. That wasn't the purpose. That monument was declared in order to get coal out of our manufacturing system. And in order to do that, they were going to have to shut down all multiple uses, which is what they've done. But that plan, as every plan, a plan has to come up for revision. It's up for revision now, and so we're going to take on the revision under coordination. In addition to that, there's one more thing that's going on down there. There's the Arizona Strip, a strip of land between Utah and Arizona, which was specifically left out of wilderness by the Congress. They exempted it. They eliminated it by legal description and by definition, and they did so and left it in multiple use. The reason they did that is that on that strip of land is more than 80% of all of the uranium deposit in the United States. We now are importing more than 80% of all the uranium we use. Secretary of Interior, about 8 or 9 months ago, served notice that he intended to withdraw that land from multiple use. And those counties, I'm helping those counties fight that now, because he's trying to, one uranium company already works there, he's trying to put them out of business and block any others from coming in by withdrawing the land in specific violation of what Congress did. So, and that's connected with the monument, because it's right outside the monument.
And so, part of, you know, these monuments are supposed to be, you know, designating this ground for historical treasure and all that. But when you start talking about millions of acres that just happen to have huge resources on them, like, you know, uranium or coal or whatever, it really doesn't look very honest.
Well, it isn't. They're done for political reasons. The monument, the Antiquities Act, was passed by Congress specifically for small places where a monument stood for something, not millions and millions of acres. The one thing that makes no sense from a reality standpoint is the environmentalists who push for, and I shouldn't say environmentalists because we all know that most of us are environmentalists. Let's say the preservationist groups that push for monuments ignore the fact that the land that they want as a monument wouldn't be worth putting in monument status if the users, if ranchers, farmers, recreation people, loggers, coal miners had not left the land in good enough condition to merit being a monument. But they don't want the people, they want the general public to believe that the users in the West have desecrated the land and that it's necessary to preserve it. When you go back to D.C. and along the East Coast, you'll find that that's the way the people believe. They believe that they have to put monuments out here. They believe they have to put wilderness out in order to prevent destruction of the land that has where the environment's been protected by ranchers and farmers and loggers and coal miners forever.
Yeah, little do they know that we can drive for, you know, hours and hours and hours in some places and not really see much of anyone.
That's exactly right. You know, the monument up here will be, the monument issue will be critical. One of the things that I observed over the last couple of days is the real spirit of the people here, and then I got a tour where I saw the valley, and I feel now what it is that people want to save. And I got the distinct impression from people that listened to me talk endlessly as all lawyers can, that they are really in a spirited fashion ready to defend this and take it back. It's not just defending at this point. What coordination does is allow a voice through the local government for the people. It's not just for the local government. The local government serves as a train for the people to get on and take back the land that really has been taken from them through regulations. Craig, I think, can tell you, and I asked him if he would tell you about the various organizations that hopefully are going to work together with a solid front up here to show Fish and Game and show Fish and Wildlife and the Forest Service that these folks are ready to do battle together to take back their land.
Yeah, Craig, give us the list of groups that are all coalescing on this thing.
Well, there's a lot of groups here that are affected by the government regulations that have come into us over the past 20, 25 years, specifically in the last 5 years, where the Department of Fish and Game has come in and told us that we have to pay them to have our rights, and that's what we've been fighting against. And we have, like all communities, we have ad hoc groups like the Scott Valley Protect Our Water Group, very effective to be able to move through a lot of different areas. We also have our local RCD. We also, that's the Regional Conservation District. We also have our local chapter of our Farm Bureau. Everybody's interested in solving the same problem. It's the difficulty some days is to get everybody on the same page on how to solve the problems. What we have in here in Siskiyou County is a very unique situation because, as Fred said, we have a jewel of a county. We have some wonderful opportunities to develop our natural resources that we've been regulated out of. And we're learning to put new strategies on the table to where all the groups can come together to solve and resolve these problems. As in most communities, nothing's perfect. We're a little fragmented in how to get from point A to point B. We all kind of see it a little differently. But the idea here is that we've got to put the egos aside, the money aside, and take a look at the most important part of this project, which is exactly, it's like what God's will for us is in our lives, and to protect this. We are stewards of this land here. And we have to make sure that politically, economically, socially, culturally, and historically, that we do work together to embrace the fabric so it's here for our children and our great-grandchildren. That's what's really important. So a lot of this is being able to bring everybody to the table under one umbrella to cause, to solve the common problem, which is water, trees, timber, mining, all of our natural resources that the government would like to see us get rid of, or they'll take them away from us. So that's it in a nutshell.
Very cool. Where would you direct people for more information?
Well, they can go to our website, which is the Scott Valley Protect Our Water. That's called pieandpolitics.com. That's P-I-E, the letter N is in Nancy, politics.com. And we have a variety of different issues on there. We have meeting schedules for when we're getting together. Of course, you can go to the local Siskiyou County Farm Bureau webpage. They'll have some information for you. You can also check out the supervisor's webpage up here in Siskiyou County. That'll give you some information of what's coming up at the next general meetings for the supervisors. And then we have a local conservation district, the Scott Valley Conservation District. And you can go to their webpage, and they'll have information. And the last one is the Shasta Valley Conservation District, and they'll have information about the projects that they're working on. And you'll see a diverse amount of information there.
Well, I know that the Pie and Politics site, if you sign up for updates, the you don't get, you know, bombarded with information, but you are kept abreast. So I would encourage people who want to follow the issue to go to Pie and Politics and sign up for the updates. You guys do a great job of keeping people in the loop. And actually, you guys do a great job up there of communicating. You've inspired us. We met, a handful of folks met the other day and thought, okay, we've got to get our phone tree here, you know, situated and some of those things. You guys have some good plans going on up there. We're going to
cheat. With all the diversified groups that we have involved with this, and there's other groups, there's environmental groups, there's all kinds of people that are taking a good hard look at the landscape up here and how to solve these problems. So communication, we have the technology today to communicate very thoroughly, and it's really important that the people participate, because we can send you an email or an alert on something, but you got to read it. You've got to stay active in the information and take part of it in your local community. It's important that you have a phone tree. It's important that you have a very thorough email list and a fax list and a mailing list so that you can keep people up to date. The idea here is to get the majority of the people to move in the same direction. I'm a cattle rancher, so I know how difficult some days it is to get all the cows going down the same path to the next pasture. I don't know if anybody's ever tried to herd cats, but some days that's what it's like.
It's
absolutely
kind of,
pandemonium.
That's kind of where we are. Guys, we've got to take another break here and thank our advertisers. We will be back with you. You are listening to KCNR 1460 AM, Shasta Redding, the home of Free Fire Media. In honor of the phone tree, thought we'd play you a little grapevine there. You're back with We the People on KCNR here, sponsored by the Redding Tea Party. You can go to reddingteaparty.com, click on the radio button. You will see everything about this program on that page. You can email that page to a friend later today, and it will have the archive of this program on there. You will also see, got a great list of previous issue-related programs. We've got things on water. We've got a program on the unions that was last week. We've got some stuff on Agenda 21 and globalism, Rescuing a Broken America with Dr. Kaufman, smart meters, property rights, all about monuments, forest management, illegal immigration. So you've got a host of things that you can go back and listen to. So let's see, fellas, we're back with Fred Kelly Grant and with Craig Chenoweth. They're hanging out up in the beautiful Scott Valley with us this morning, talking about coordination and lots of other things to keep our land use open. Talk to me about where you go from here on the projects.
If I can just step in, I think Craig painted the picture beautifully as to the people that need to be involved and the country and what the goal is. We are forming, my daughter-in-law and two other incorporators have formed a foundation called Trademark America. And the foundation is designed to put together conferences on the 10th Amendment and put together a group of senior fellows who can give advice on policy and projects, and then a think tank of people who support private property rights, local government, the 10th Amendment, all of the things we've talked about, and produce a law journal or law review. And I think maybe I've talked to you about that once before, that we don't have on our side of the issues, we don't have a law review that judges can go to and see what scholars have written. If they go on an endangered species issue, for example, and they want to see what the law reviews say, they've got over 53 preservationist law reviews that they can look to. They don't have a one from our side. So the foundation, in fact, the first seminar on the 10th Amendment is scheduled for Sacramento April 29th and 30th. And my daughter-in-law came up with the name to the 10th power, which I thought was pretty ingenious. The first day I go through the 10th Amendment and how it developed, how it was, what it meant, what it means today, the cases that support it, and the implementation that can be made of the 10th, not only by government, but by citizens' coalitions. And that's becoming more and more important to me when I see around the country the groups of citizens who are getting together to try to take back what's been taken from them. The tool that they can use is not only their political structure, but also then finding some town, if they can't get the county to do it, some town or some district that will coordinate, and then they can use that that local government. The local government can represent them through coordination and present the views of the citizens. Along with those citizens, business can do that. The businesses, industries that are reliant on natural resource production don't have the same status as local government. They don't have the right to coordinate with the government, but the local government does for them because it affects the economy. It affects jobs. The President of the United States issued an executive order on January 18th of this year telling all federal agencies that they must review all their rules and regulations and revise any that hold down the economy that are anti-job production. Well, the agencies won't do that on their own. It takes local government and it takes citizens to make them do it. The foundation is hopefully going to guide those things, and one of the things I have to go back and talk to the board of directors about is making this valley, Scott Valley, and the entire county the first project for the foundation, where we go in and try to look at species and issues that have just been ramrodded through by the federal agencies, and looking at just taking back the land and the water from the regulatory bureaucrats.
That's great. Gosh,
it's a really important concept, because the idea here, or what's been happening to us for years, as we've tried to cooperate with different state and federal agencies, we seem to be giving up everything, and they take everything. And it's never worked. They've always buried us. When we try and say, okay, well, give us the information we need to read, well, they'll show up with a few thousand pages of documents intentionally to bury us in the bureaucracy. And that's what we have learned from Fred so wonderfully, is how to streamline that process, walk into a meeting where they have a 1,000-page document and say, hey, put it on 25 pages or less, otherwise we're not going to look at this. It's that concept that we have to get to a place to where we're going to understand how the system will actually be beneficial for us. Again, the state and federal agencies want to solve the same problems that we want to solve, but it's putting aside all the differences and getting to right down to the issue, real common sense, and getting there without the egos, the money, and the power trips that'll get us to actually solve the problems. One of the things that we've talked a lot about up here, as you know, Aaron, over the years, is trying to develop, you know, a science that is going to be unbiased and can be checked and thoroughly documented and doing that. And that's another big area that we'll move into, like what Fred does and how he's going to look at this project, is setting up a great coalition between all the groups that we just talked about previously and being able to put everybody on the same page, put the science down, take a look at the numbers, and see how it will evolve to solve the problem.
Well, we sit in those meetings. I mean, I've been in those meetings with you guys, and we sit in there and they talk about all this, you know, science and this and that and the other, and you have experts in the room like John Menke who completely debunk their science, and yet because he isn't with some agency anymore, he doesn't have any clout. So this will bring those guys back to the table, you think?
Well, it will, and he does have clout. It just isn't generally known. We can use, through the process, we can use the Data Quality Act, which I've used in several places now very successfully, in order to stop a regulatory takeover of some function. We can use the Regulatory Flexibility Act. There's a whole host of tools to implement the 10th Amendment power of the people in local government. And all of those I'll discuss in Sacramento at the seminars. The reason that I'm willing to go back to the board and suggest that this be our first major project is that I've seen such talent up here. Not only in networking, but in science and in the skills of knowledge that we need to succeed. It's not just because I like the people or the land, because the first project we take on is going to have to win. And I'm not going to take on one that I think will lose. I'm impressed by these folks, and I think if they get on the same page and move together, which I'm sure they will, it's a win that we can make that will be a precedent-setting win for the entire nation. Nobody has tried to do this. Nobody has tried to take on a whole landscape like this and solve it through the coordination process. We did it in Owyhee County, but it took us 11 years to go through Congress and do it. What we're going to try to do it is in streamlined fashion and do it administratively.
That's awesome. Well, you have premier experts in every field up there. They not only are the premier experts, but they're landowners, they're ranchers, they're farmers, they're users of the land, so they have a vested interest in all this. So they have practical knowledge as well as credentials, fantastic credentials. So you have this, you've got a real wealth of knowledge, and they're being hammered from every side. So
that's true, and I've got at our disposal from other parts of the country, and at the disposal of the foundation will be other experts to corroborate these folks so that we can bring somebody on water, on the watershed from Colorado, to support what the experts here say, so that we're not going in with a group that the agencies can say, well, of course he's biased. You can't be biased if it's real science as these folks are relying on, but we can bring in people to show that, so that we'll go in with a pretty formidable task force. It's like when I used to prepare a big case at Lord Bissell and Brook, you brought together a task force, and the goal was to keep your eye on the win that you wanted, and everybody worked at that. You divided up tasks so that each group of people had a particular task they had to work on, and when you finally come back together, you've got a trial strategy that can win. I look at this as just like preparing for a big trial without going to court. And if you end up having to go to court, so be it. You've got a winning case at that point.
Yeah, these are like a bunch of professional players who all retired to the same area, and then voila, here comes the coach, I think this is going to be great, and people all around the country are going to benefit from this.
And then you hope the coach is more like Lombardi than some of the others that get kicked down the road.
Yeah, just, you know what, Fred, just a word to the wise, just if you look at what's going on with football, don't let them unionize. It's going to ruin the whole season.
It certainly is. It's going to make me a college football fan all over again.
Right. Yeah, isn't it amazing?
The neat thing about this analogy is that what we're learning with the tools from Fred right now is how to stay in the offense, keep moving forward. We know there's going to be distractions along the way, but through the 10th Amendment and the bag of tools that this man has been offering us this weekend, we have the ability not to live in the defense anymore. We're tired of it. We don't want to play that game. It's been a very conscious effort on the government's part to keep us there so that we can't move forward. But what we've learned this weekend through Fred Kelly Grant, and we're excited about this meeting coming up in Sacramento and learning more about the foundation, is to have the tools to keep pressing for that goal line. And the goal is not to screw one agency or another agency or one community or one group out of whatever they think that they should be screwed out. The idea is to bring everybody together to march for the same goal and to work to have a great environment to live in, have more water, you know what to do with, more fish, you know what to do with, whatever the issue is.
We got to take a break here, Craig. It's going to cut us off to do the news. We're going to come back right after the 5-minute news break. You are listening to KCNR 1460 AM, the home of Free Fire Media. Good morning. You are back with the second hour of We the People, brought to you by the Reading Tea Party. You can go to readingteaparty.com, click on radio, and you will be right there on the fantastic radio page that Robert has created, complete with archives and all of our advertisers. On our advertisers this morning, I should put a little blurb in there before I forget. We have Miller Auto Transport. We have North State Consultants, and very timely for North State Consultants right now, because these are the guys who help you keep the money that you've earned rather than give it all to the IRS. And I'll tell you the same thing I would tell any of my friends, which is you should take the last 3 years of tax returns to Mark and Linda and Linda, have them look at it, and if they don't find you money, I would be shocked. So their phone number is 530-221-0101. And their information's on our radio page as well. Also, we've got All Temp Tactical Lube. at Jim and Nancy Myatt. That is a fantastic product. We'll get into that second half hour here. So this half hour is brought to you by North State Consultants. Thanks, guys. We know you're slaving away because it's that time of year. So welcome back, Fred and Craig. So, Fred, you, when we left, we were talking about 10th Amendment. Now, for folks that haven't taken any constitutional classes since 8th grade, give people a thumbnail on 10th Amendment so we know everybody knows what we're talking about.
Okay. The 10th Amendment is the it's the last of the amendments in the Bill of Rights, and it's the one that that four of the states, four of the 13 original states, refused to ratify the Constitution until the 10th Amendment and the other first nine were attached. The concept of the 10th Amendment was simple. The people who went in to write the Constitution had the power. They were representing the people. Some of them, they had been chosen by state as state delegations, but they were there representing local people, and they knew it. When you do research on the continental government, you realize that local government was the powerful government. These folks didn't come to that. I know that in all the debates which I've read, it was always the concept that this was their local, that their county, their town that they were there representing. They are the ones that gave the power to the national government. They sat there, and in deciding what was going into the Constitution, they decided which of the powers of the people they were going to give up to the national government. When they did that, and basically there were two, to provide for the national defense, to be able to tax, to provide that defense, and the second was interstate commerce. The problem in regulation of interstate commerce at the time was that a manufacturer in Massachusetts shipping to South Carolina might have to go through seven state tariffs and change currencies seven times in traffic down there. So that was the idea about that. Everything else, other than what was given to the national government in the Constitution, was kept with the people with the power. That's the people. And so the 10th Amendment simply said everything that we haven't given to the federal government, the national government in this Constitution, and everything that isn't prohibited for the states to do is reserved to the states and to the people. In other words, what we gave you, we gave you. Everything else is still ours. Now, some people today, even scholars, like to say that the 10th Amendment created certain powers in the states, and that's not true. It didn't create anything. It reserved, it made clear that all you get as a national government is what we gave you. The sovereignty of the states and the sovereignty of the people through the local government is still there, just as it was on the day that the states ratified the Constitution and the amendments. Now, I saw two scholars about a month ago or so on television in Boise, one from the University of Idaho, one from Boise State University. Both say sovereignty, there's no such thing as state sovereignty anymore. That was settled by the Civil War. That's not true at all. The 10th Amendment sovereignty is there. It's the most important amendment. In fact, to me, it's the most important part of the Constitution, because what it does say is that we are not going to accept unconstitutional overreach by the national government into those powers that we didn't give you. Now, at the seminar, I go into that in great detail, including the cases which have said it, and also the implementation of that, and how the states today are once again rediscovering this amendment because of the fact that the federal government has just become so powerful through regulatory faction. You know, one of the things that always reminds me of how important local and state government was when you go to the Lee Custis Mansion in Arlington National Cemetery, overlooking that beautiful mall from the Washington Monument to the Capitol, and you stand in that room and look at the table where Robert E. Lee resigned the most important military position in the world as commander of the Union Army so that he could become the leader of the Confederate troops, not because of slavery, not because of secession, but as he said in his letter, I cannot desert my Virginia. That to me, of all the things in history, is probably the greatest moment to show how important state and local government was to the great people in our history.
And I think you're exactly right. I think people are rediscovering that because, you know, we've been, I don't know if we've been lazy or we've just been trusting, or I think in some cases we've just been bad stewards in a way. We've let the government creep in and creep in and creep in, and not through laws that we voted, but through regulation. It's
most of our lives,
the Department of whatever.
Yeah. Most of our times in our lives, we get too busy and we have a lot of distractions in our world today, whether it's the technology that we're dealing with, our work lives, our commute to work, whatever it is, we've lost focus on local government. One of the things that the 10th Amendment that Fred explained so well is that I always thought that, well, geez, we've got to take back control. Well, it's not about control. It's about having a constitutional government in place that first and foremost stands up for the Constitution of the United States and for the state government, for the state constitution. By having folks that understand that position as our leaders in our county governments, in our cities, and in our towns, we have solved an incredible problem there in terms of dealing with the bureaucracy. Fred understands, and I think I'm getting a grasp of this, is that here in California, I can't fight Sacramento. I can't fight Washington, D.C. The bureaucracies are just overwhelming. They seem to have all the answers for us down there, but they've never even been on our land. But they're going to tell us what to do. The idea of having a constitutional government in place, having people, elected officials, that will first and foremost live up to the oath of office that they take, which is to stand up for the Constitution of the United States and for the Constitution of California. If you have that first and foremost concept in their minds, that it's very clear to them how to go beyond that, which is basically using that principle and how they're going to delegate and regulate the acts that were within the county or within the city based on constitutional principles. Geez, what a concept.
No kidding. Well, and
sounds absolutely wonderful to me.
Well, if you think about it, the elections that are the most the lowest voter turnout is usually for local elections. And you think, you know,
and
really, isn't that just backwards? Those are the people you can know the best. Those are the people you can actually meet, spend time with, and learn about. And those are the people who have the most direct influence on your life. So I guess I see it as kind of a benefit. You know, we will potentially revive the importance of local elections. And I know the other thing, too, is judges. I've heard that from more people, that every time an election rolls around, here are the judges we vote for again, and people don't know who they are. So I know this last election, we had more and more people at the Tea Party wanted to know about the judges, and I don't think we're going to get caught flat-footed again this time. Hey, guys, we've got to take a real quick break here at the quarter hour. And we will come right back with you for more on Scott Valley and Siskiyou County and coordination and all sorts of good stuff. So you are listening to We the People here on KCNR, 1460 AM, Shasta Redding, the home of Free Fire Media. Welcome back to We the People. You are listening to us on KCNR 1460 AM. We are brought to you by the Redding Tea Party, so please go to our page at reddingteaparty.com. Click on radio. You'll be on our fantastic media page. It is looking better every single day. Robert's doing a fantastic job. You'll find a link there for this program. You'll also have it in archive form later on this afternoon. You can email that page to a friend and get them caught up on things. There are lots of other issues in the queue that you can get smart about and also forward on to friends. You also have the ability to order these programs on CD. So lots of choices there. And so we've got a question here from Nate. See, we've got both our phone lines tied up, so the only people who get to ask questions are the people in the station. All right, fire away, Nate.
Hey, hello, guys. I love what you guys are talking about. I totally agree that the local level is obviously where the most power is supposed to be, then state, then the federal government. But what do you do when they fight or when they write laws like the Federal Supremacy Act, which states that they can trump any state law? And then what else? I'm sure you also, do they come at you guys with the Commerce Clause a lot? Those are my two questions.
First of all, let's take the Supremacy Clause. The coordination process that we use against the federal agencies is very simple, because under the Supremacy Clause, federal laws, if constitutional, are supreme. So what we're using is the supreme law of the land. When the agencies first, 20 years ago, started resisting my coordination efforts, they used the Supremacy Clause, and I simply pointed out that we were using federal statutes. Therefore, the Supremacy Clause required them to come and coordinate with us. Once in a while, you still get a federal agency that isn't familiar with this, and they throw that in, and that's our answer. The second thing is that that's the importance of the Tenth Amendment. If the federal government, if the national government, let's put, if Congress passes a law that exceeds their authority over state and people's power, then the states and the people have to object to it and have to protest it. The last case that did that was the case where the Congress passed the Brady Gun Act and then required local law officers to enforce it. The sheriff from Ravalli County in Montana, and I don't know whether Craig remembers, but a sheriff from somewhere in Arizona, took an action, and they challenged the law on the basis that the police power of local police was protected under the Tenth Amendment, that Congress could not interfere with the duties of local officers. The Supreme Court of the United States agreed, and they set aside that provision of Congress and said that it was in violation of local rights under the Tenth Amendment. There are other cases where the same thing happens, and the concept today is that if the states move out, and if local government moves out and establishes laws, establishes protective laws under the Tenth Amendment, and the Congress tries to interfere with that, we've got a court now that is even stronger than it was at the time they issued the Brady case, and we just challenge it, because under the Supremacy Clause, the only federal law that is supreme is if it's constitutional. If it invades the rights of the people and the states, then it's not constitutional because it violates the Tenth Amendment.
Nice.
Now, the other question was the Commerce Clause. Yeah, we get that thrown at us all the time, but, you know, what we have to do is turn that around. Every weapon that's used against us, we can turn around and use the other way. One of the great examples, I think, and Craig may want to talk about this too, is the National Environmental Policy Act. For many years, ranchers and farmers and private property owners thought that NEPA was against them. They thought that, and that's because the preservationist groups got to court first and they used it, and so everybody thought, oh Lord, this thing puts every species above man. That's not true. We used it in Texas to stop the Trans-Texas Corridor. And once we started studying the history of that act, I fell into the trap the way everybody else did. I thought it was an act that was anti-human. It's not. When you read the language of the act, it protects the human environment and says that they should protect the human environment in harmony with the natural environment. And when the Council on Environmental Quality defined a human environment, they defined it as including aesthetic values, just like the beauty that I look out this window at right now, culture, custom, economy, religion. All of those things have to be protected under NEPA. Well, we turn that around now. We use that as a weapon against the agencies, and we say, look, you haven't complied with this law because you haven't taken into account the economy of Siskiyou County in making these decisions. You haven't taken into account the custom, the culture of the folks here. You haven't taken into account the aesthetic beauty of this. And And so what we're doing is, and what I would propose that the foundation do is come up and help these folks establish it from the other way around. Not defensive, not preventively defending against the federal agencies, but turn it around and put them on the defense and say, we're taking this back. Here's the proposal. Here is our project. This is the way we're going to protect the human environment and, in harmony, the natural environment up here.
How's that, Nate?
That was great. Thank you.
You're welcome. As I said a couple of times yesterday, you know, I don't believe in... I use football a lot as analogies, and I don't believe in the prevent defense because all it does is prevent you from winning. And for too long, we have stood on the ground and we've defended against the bureaucrats. It's time now, and I've started over the last few years with several local governments. It's time now to turn that around, and we move out positively, and we make the federal people start to defend.
Yeah, that's,
exactly.
That's about the way it's got to go.
You betcha. And, you know, we've lived too long in a society. Somehow we evolved in this position to where we've given our state and federal agencies the concept of, or the appearance of having the authority over our lives, when it's never, was never intended to be that way. I know for myself, when I stood up at one of our first meetings about a year and a half ago, and I said the greatest tyranny that we face today in our society here in Scott Valley is our own government, and that's got to be changed. And that's something that stuck as a principle as far as we've gone forward and helped accomplish so many wonderful things in the last year about putting government back into perspective. And these concepts that Fred is teaching us through the 10th Amendment, in working on an effective level with the information that the government and the state and federal agencies you want to use against us to keep us down, keep us controlled, keep us buried in the bureaucracy. The idea here, again, as I say, it's most important psychologically to get back onto the offensive and to be on the winning side, and if you stay focused on the goals and use the tools that we have. And that's what Fred's so wonderful at getting us to accomplish and to recognize, that we have these tools in our lives every day, and we just have to stand on them.
Well, you get a nice team of people completely trained and ready to weigh in on this stuff, and it'll be a long time before, before they roll us over again. But you guys are literally, I keep telling people that, you know, Siskiyou County is the tip of the spear. And
right. We have a couple of great guys here in our ballpark.
Yeah.
Doug LaMaffa, Senator LaMaffa. We have Assemblyman Jill Nielsen. And they're going to stand up for us, and they're going to make sure that when the government agencies now come at us, they're going to let us hopefully know first, and so that we have the opportunity to examine the information that they would like to penetrate onto us. We want to be sure that with these guys, LaMaffa and Nielsen, that with this team of working together, that we can actually come to a better conclusion and to a better understanding of how to solve the problems than anybody else has, because we live here. We live in the dirt, in the environment, on the streets. We have the concept of observation that no other politician, state or federal agency has, because we are here, we're doing it every day. For myself, I am an all-natural cattle producer. I care a lot about my environment. I operate my ranch by organic standards. It is a phenomenal lifestyle to have and to be able to do this. The last thing I want to do or have happen to my enterprise and to become less successful is to have government intrusion that's going to nick me to death with fines and penalties and rules and regulations and stacks of paperwork that I've got to fill out to do all that kind of stuff. That's not the way I want to live. I need to be profitable and sustainable at the same time. But profitable's got to come first, because I want to pay my taxes, so I have roads and schools. I don't think sometimes that the state and federal government understands that by keeping us in a codependent relationship with them physically, that's never going to create more revenue for them. What we have to do now is get out from underneath the codependent relationship, open up our natural resources, which they have regulated us out of, go back to work so we become a viable, independent tax base and no longer codependent on state and federal governments for handouts. This is something that our society has moved into. Oh, the government will take care of us. We can get a grant for this. Well, all this stuff comes with strings, and I call them the strings of bondage, because the moment you accept this, you've lost whatever your goal or your principle was, because they're going to tell you how to complete this. They have the answer for us, but they've never, ever been here. They've never understood our environment.
Well,
that's an important concept that we've learned.
The other thing is, the really salient point Fred opened the program with is that if you guys were truly poor stewards of the land and the resources up there, it would be gone already.
That's
right. These guys just showed up to save it, but who's been there the whole time? And if we were talking about it last night at the law enforcement dinner, if you guys were allowed to utilize the resources up there, I mean, and all of them, you know, manage the timber properly and harvest it and do all those things, if you were allowed to manage the fisheries, if you were allowed to manage all of that, your county would get financially healthy instantly. You'd solve tons of problems. You'd get rid of all the drug dealers on your public lands. Your crime rate would go way down. Your schools would have more money. Everything gets handled in one fell swoop, and now it's just being eroded bit by bit. Hey guys, we have take another little break here. Thank our advertisers, and we will be right back with you in a couple of minutes here at We the People. You are listening to KCNR 1460 AM, Shasta Redding, the home of Free Fire Media. Welcome back to We the People. You probably noticed we have better music this week. At least we have a lot more of it. Thank goodness for all those people that were going, if they play that Down on the Corner song one more time, I'm going to pull my eyelashes out. Bill has been working diligently on our music to give us some choices, which is fantastic. So here on We the People, we are sponsored by the Redding Tea Party. You can go to reddingteaparty.com, click on radio, and you'll get all the information about this program and lots of others. You can send the archive to a friend later on, and I would really encourage you to listen next week. Just a little promo on that. We recorded it a week or two ago, actually. Guy was traveling here from England, does a lot of work pushing back on the political Islam that is just overtaking Europe, and I think that will be very enlightening. For all those people who still think that Islam is just a religion with some people that apply it poorly, I would invite you to listen to the program next week. I think you'll get a whole new perspective, and based in history, based in scholarly study. So anyway, I encourage you to plug into that. This section is sponsored by North State Consultants. Keep your money. Don't give it to the IRS. Give them a call, 530-221-0101. And Alltemp Tactical Lube, Jim and Nancy Myatt. So if you have firearms you would like to lube, this stuff is incredible. And if you have doorknobs that are squeaky, it's incredible. If you have microphones in a radio station that don't swivel right, it's incredible. So save your money and spend it on Tactical Lube. I guess that, there you go. There's my joint commercial for them. So we're back with Fred Kelly Grant and Craig Chenoweth. We're talking about coordination and governmental overreach and how we're taking back our world from them. Isn't that about the size of it, Fred?
Well, it's Craig here. I was just going to finish one thought from what we were talking about before the break.
Well, you just go right ahead.
Thank you. Basically, I'm standing here in a big picture window on kind of a drizzly day, looking at the Marble Mountains, and it's probably snowing up top there. And I'm looking out across this valley, and one of the things that attracted me to spending the rest of my life here are the citizens of this valley. There are so many wonderful families that have been here for over 150 years, and we were talking about earlier about being great stewards of the land. These folks have learned to adapt and to economize and to still somehow stay profitable for the last 150 years. They've gone through the depressions and the wars and all the conflicts politically and otherwise, and yet they are the backbone and the fabric of what makes this valley work. You couldn't have a better example of a group of people who have suffered under the tyranny of the government for all the regulations. I mean, agriculture is one of the most over-related industries that we have in the United States. But these folks have seemed to come to a place in their lives where they are excellent at managing and working this land and squeezing out every dime and nickel from it, but also having a piece of land that will be there tomorrow because they haven't used it and abused it and used it up so it can no longer be done. The neat thing about the agricultural community here in Scott Valley is the value of these families, their history, their culture, their outlook on life is probably one of the most significant things I've ever experienced in my life. So I just wanted to say how much I really appreciate that.
Well, I think it's a unique combination, and I think the fact that all the bureaucracies, Fish and Game, Fish and Wildlife, Bureau of Reclamation, Bureau of Land Management, Department of the Interior, did I leave anybody out?
Homeland Security.
Oh, yeah, yeah, those guys. I mean, the fact that they all decided to target this area, I'm sure it seemed like this is just going to be a cakewalk. We're going to blow in, we're going to shut off their water, we're going to just regulate the heck out of them, drop a monument on them, take out their dams, and that'll be that. You know, they thought they'd be in and out.
Yeah, they did that in the Klamath Basin before, and local government did not step up and do what they could have under the statutes. They tried it in Owyhee County. They've left the Intermountain West now pretty much because the grazing counties took them on, and we used coordination to whip them back pretty good. So now they've come to the basin. They've come to the places where farmers and ranchers need the irrigation water, and the fish issue, the salmon issues here. And so you're exactly right. They took on bigger issues that they felt the people, number one, wouldn't be able to afford to resist. Number two, wouldn't be able to figure out a process by which they could simplify all this and beat them on it.
Well, they also underestimated the just the sheer knowledge of the people in that area. You have people the consummate expert. I told the guy from the Department of the Interior at one of those meetings, I said, you know, you wish you had people like John Menke on your staff. You wish you were working with that kind of science.
And we've got those scientists. We've got some scientists like that in virtually every area that we take them on. They are scientists who decided that they couldn't be perverted anymore by the demands of agencies that required them to come up with fake science. It's like the study that led to the cutoff of the water in the Klamath Basin, done by a professor at Utah State, who later pointed out that he was wrong. Pointed out that his study was wrong, but it was too late. At that point, we were unable to get scientists to step forward because there was too much money involved to their universities through grants from the government that would be cut off if the scientists told the truth. Well, fortunately, we're in a position now where we've got enough scientists who have either retired from the government because of the fact that they could not stand it anymore. Or for some other reason, and now they're sick of fake science being used, and they're prepared to step forward for us.
Well, that is truly your ace in the hole, because so much of it, you know, the really sad part is, it's almost all their vast scientific knowledge is almost wasted because common sense. Really could step in. I mean, you look at the Central Valley of California and you think, really? We've killed all that farmland for a bait fish, you know? I mean, I'm not a scientist, but how does that make sense?
So much of our government has relied on bogus science for so long to keep them in business. And this is something, the transition that we've seen in our last election in November, is that we've got to cut the waste out. And the boys in the House and the new group of 55 out there, they're doing a phenomenal job of tackling a problem that's existed for 50 years. And it's not going to be solved overnight. But what they're taking a good hard look at is with common sense on how the bureaucracy has become so muddled, so overlapping, so abusive, so spendy in terms of how they're dealing with our tax dollars and where exactly and whose pocket it's going into. We're in a phenomenal and should be very optimistic time of our lives, because all the elements for change are with us. We have to seize the opportunity. We have to get focused on the ground underneath our feet first and make sure that the local governments are effective, cooperative, on a level that won't sell us out. So I don't want to scare anybody when I use the cooperative word, but the idea that we can work with each other, all the different groups like in Scott Valley that have a vested interest on making sure we're here tomorrow, we can come to the table and resolve these problems. And what the lesson that Fred has taught us this weekend up here, and I hope more of you call Fred and get him to come to your communities, because the lessons that we have learned is about how to solve the problems on a constitutional level first, which is the guiding light and the focus for moving forward. And it's been a phenomenal experience.
Go ahead. Oh, I was just going to say, did you find that this was a new bit of information for most people, Craig?
Absolutely. We learned so much because we had the concepts, we had the ideas that were in our heads, we were able to read them. But once Fred was on the ground here and began to look at our specific environment, first thing we did is we brought him to Scott Valley and we spent several hours driving around to all the different enclaves and little ecosystems so he could take a look at how this valley operates and see the diversity in it. It's not just a blanket piece of land that could be duplicated in Nebraska or Wyoming or in Kentucky or Tennessee or North Carolina. It can't be done like that. So he got a good impression, and because of his vast knowledge of understanding the environment, he was able to take what we have here, translate it into the tools that we can use to move forward to solve the problems. We all seem to have the same goals, and that includes the state and federal agencies, as I said earlier. It's how we solve the problems that's going to be beneficial, first and foremost, to the people on the ground. They should be the ones that govern the change that will help them transform this into a better productive environment where we are coexisting with all the environment and all the issues that are being put before us. We have no problem with trying to save fish and be better stewards of our water. That's not the question. The question is whether government's going to do it for us and tell us how to do it, or whether we have the tools to work with the government and have us be in the driver's seat instead of them being in the tyranny seat. We'll get along much better with our government if we can achieve those goals.
Yeah, that always does make a big difference. You know, in our last 15 minutes, would you do, I had told people, oh, we're also going to talk about charter city, charter county, but we kind of haven't done that. Could you give us a little bit of an overview, Fred, why don't we take our break a little bit early, and that'll give us a little more time at the end there. Maybe you could give us an overview on some of that, because Reading is currently looking at a charter city option, and we could use some expert advice, actually. So you're listening to We the People here on KCNR 1460 AM, Shasta Reading, the home of Free Fire Media.
Somebody's been shot, somebody's been abused, somebody blew up a building, somebody stole a car, somebody got away, somebody didn't get too far, yeah, they didn't get too far.
Grandpappy told my pappy back in my day, son, a man had to answer.
Welcome back to We the People. I thought I'd play a little music for the guys up in Scott Valley. A little beer for my horses there. Did you already know that one, boys?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know that one. But Bill, of course, the eclectic musical genius that he is, he pulled that one. So
I have to tell you what a musical genius I am, and that's why I'm a lawyer. I was a disc jockey in my years in college at a big radio station in Nampa, 50,000 watts. I was on duty the day the first Elvis Presley record came in.
Wow.
It was the Milk Bucket Boogie. And not many people even know he ever recorded it. And I played it, and then when the other DJs came in, I played it, and we all laughed, and I said, well, this guy won't make it. And so that's the reason, I guess, I'm not still in music.
Yeah, that would have been like, what was it, the president of IBM back then, he said there was a world market for maybe one computer.
Right, right.
And it's like, oh, whoopsie. hey, tell me this, Fred. Can you give us a kind of a thumbnail sketch here in the last, 10 minutes or so of what Charter City or Charter County, or if you can, talk about them as one, I'm not sure. Besides the fact it gives us choices, what's the benefit?
I think I can talk about it as one. The California Constitution allows a city, town, or a county to become a charter government. And a charter relates to home rule. And when you say home rule, most people have some better idea of what it is than to say a charter. In most states, it's called a home rule city or home rule county. If the city or county, and then the statutes in California set out the way you go about it. It's a simple matter of the mayor and city council of a city or the board of supervisors for a county deciding that they want to charter themselves as a charter government. If they do that, then it changes the whole nature of the government of that particular unit of local government. There are two types of government in California. One is the general law local government. The other is charter local government. If you go the charter route, there are many more things that you can do free of state interference. The California statute says that a charter city or a charter county has the capacity and the authority to exercise all municipal duties and powers. The only thing they can't do is anything that is almost genetically statewide. And municipal then has been defined by the various courts in California to include the local police, local election rules for local offices, local taxation, local land use policy, as long as and zoning, with a few exceptions that would take us much longer than 15 minutes to even go through. But so let's say local planning and zoning, because basically that's true, and anything else that you typically think about as being a police power under the 10th Amendment, and that is anything that works for the public safety, public health, or public welfare. The sheriffs, for example, they already are the primary law officer under the Constitution of every state, but under Charter County, they assume even more responsibility and duty and authority than they do if the county is a general government county. The advantage to a town or city or county is that they can begin to plan more specifically for their citizens than they can if they're a general law county or city and bound specifically to the terms of the general planning statute of the state. Now, the charter government, the home rule government, still must comply with the elements of a plan that the California legislature sets, but they don't have to comply with the specifics of the elements. For example, if one of the elements in the general planning statute says that housing will be provided for in the plan, a charter government or a home rule government can define what is in its planning for housing in its own way and not governed by anything that the state has put down as a rule or a regulation. Now, Craig, that's in a nutshell. I don't know whether there's anything that I've left out, but it is purely up to the governing body of the county or the city as to whether they become a charter, home rule, city or county. The state has no say in it. If the Board of Supervisors decides or if the city council and mayor decide that they are going to be a charter government, then so be it. That's what happens.
And what would be the downside to that?
Well, the downside for elected officials is they got to work a little harder they certainly can't say to their citizens, well, the state made us do it, and that's done a lot of times. The downside would be that it might be a little more costly, might be extremely more costly, but it also would, on the reverse side of that, it also gives the local government that's a charter government a better opportunity to economically develop within its boundaries without state regulations and state limitations, so that the hope would be that you would build economically in order to offset the extra costs. One of the difficulties when local government gets tangled up and tangled down by state money and federal money is, for example, let's take the Forest Receipts Bill. In order to make up for the logging industry going under, Congress decided to appropriate money for forest receipts to the counties that had previously relied on logging. Problem with that is that's just money. And it's money that's given at the discretion of Congress. That's not jobs. That's not jobs that keep families and keep kids in the schools and so on. So those forest receipts are a poor substitute for what you would have if the local government could rebuild its economy, rebuild jobs that keep families in the city or the county, because that helps keep kids in the school, and it keeps the schools in a more efficient operation.
Now, when you said it costs more money, in what regard? What would be the increase? Where would you see the increased cost?
Well, for example, you would very likely, if I were a supervisor, or let's say if I were a mayor, and the city council and I decided we want to go to a charter, I'd make sure that we had at least one very efficient and skillful and knowledgeable and also committed person to manage the government. I wouldn't attempt to do it through the regular city council and mayor, most of whom don't have the kind of business experience in local government that they could go out and produce the type of economic projects that we're talking about. That would be one cost. In addition to that, you know, as it is now, if you want to do a plan and all you want to do is a land use plan and all you want to do is do what the state suggests, all you got to do is really copy the state. They'll provide it for you because they want to. They want to restrict you. So it would cost you to have somebody talented and skillful do that plan for you. Those are the kind of things, I mean, that would be more costly.
But we already have, well, at least here anyway, like in the city of Reading, we already have a city manager who's 250 plus thousand per year.
Yeah, in the city of Reading, I don't see a downside. There may be, but I don't see one because of the authority that would be given to the people. People went into the city council chambers and watched a proceeding of the government. They would know that their government was really the one they had to come to voice their complaints, and they could get some response. When you go into a general law, county or city, I have heard it over the years so many times, well, we can't help it, the state makes us do it. We can't help it, the federal government makes us do it. You know, I'm going to say something that won't be very popular, I suppose. You know, I was counsel to two governors in Idaho, as I said, and I've watched over the years, I've watched the training that is given to newly elected local officials. They go to training that's put on by the state. And the first thing that we did, and I did it as counsel for the governors, the first thing we did was try to convince those local elected officials that they had no more authority than what we gave them and allowed them. Because it's not to the state's advantage to have cities and counties out there thinking for themselves. And a charter government gets you out of that because you know right away when you go into it, the state doesn't tell you what to do. They will try, but they don't have the authority to tell you what to do. I don't know whether that happens up here or not. I know it did in Idaho. I know it did in Maryland. When the elected officials came back, they came back from that first training session so intimidated that you couldn't convince them that they had the authority to do anything except look at the latest memo from the state.
Our guys are pretty good, but what we're finding, we actually have a charter city commissioner panel or whatever it is. There are 10 of us, and I drew a short straw, so I'm doing that. And at our last meeting, I mean, we were met with, you know, tons of union protest at the door, and the signs actually were pretty funny. They said, charter city equals big government.
Exactly.
And it was
the opposite.
Yeah, it was like, okay, for one, that's exactly the opposite, and hey, aren't you guys big fans? It was kind of odd, and they were trying to tell everybody that there would be, you know, higher taxes and all this, and you can't change those kinds of things. I mean, the law still applies.
What the folks in the unions have to understand is that the idea of the charter cities and counties is to become more fiscally profitable. When there's more profitability within the city or the county, we have more roads to pave, we have more trash cans to pick up, we've got to work on our schools, our libraries, everything. So it's actually an economic success for everybody. The success of home rule far outweighs the money and the time that it takes to develop it, because the idea here is to become fiscally independent of the state and the federal government. So they won't be able to tell us what to do and how to do it. But with having the home rule, and when they push on us to do something, and we actually think that might be a good idea, well, we get to define the terms of the conditions by which that will be implemented. If we're not in a charter city or county government, the states or the federal government is doing what they're doing is today, is they're putting us into a position
of
codependence and shoving this down our throats.
We take what we get. Hey, fellas, we're in the last 40 seconds here, so I wanted to give you all a proper send-off, and we're going to see you this afternoon, 3 o'clock at Tobacco and Brew there on Hilltop Drive, and we're going to talk some more about all of these issues. Thank you so much for being with us this morning. Fred, as always, we enjoy getting smarter. And
don't forget April 29th and 30th in Sacramento. That starts my constitutional education courses, a whole series of courses, and we're starting with the 10th.
Great. We're putting them online, readingteaparty.com. Guys, go there for all the info. You are listening to KCNR 1460 AM, Shasta Reading, the home of Free Fire Media.